Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On today's episode of Wandering DMs, we have the opportunity to speak to game designer Adriel Wilson of Ninth Level Games. And I think her most recent project is The Excellence, All Princess Role-Playing, which Paul and I both looked at, and we've seen your recent live play for that. So we are really, really looking forward to speaking about Adriel today about stories and games and preparation and how one story can lead into another. So thanks for joining us, Adriel.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you guys today.
Cool. Awesome.
So I feel like I need to start with the amusing anecdote of how Adriel and I met, because it's personally embarrassing to me, so I like to tell it. Adriel and I met at Origins a couple years back, which, by the way, I've heard, I guess they're moving it to October this year, so I'm hoping they pull it off. It's the one and only time I made it. Yeah, yeah. It's the only time I've actually made it to Origins, and I'd love to go back. So, you were there, Adriel, and I think you were running some demos of a game that I played in, and then you told me about Cobalt Ate My Baby game, and so I came to that. And then cut to, I don't know, maybe just a month or two later, and you started a new job at Disruptor Beam where I was working. And I probably spent a good week staring at you across the office going, how do I know her? What? I'm sure we've met. And I couldn't place it. And I couldn't place it forever. And it was too embarrassed to say anything. And then finally, someday, it clicked. I went, oh, you were at Origins.
Yeah, it was the same for me. Like, you look super familiar, but again, like, I couldn't place you because I meet so many people at conventions and their faces just, like, lock into my brain.
Yep.
But oftentimes the surrounding information doesn't. So I'll be like, I know that person, but who could know from where?
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Meeting folks at conventions, it's a weird kind of tenuous, like, you're best friends for a day and then... maybe I'll never see that person again.
Right. Or maybe you'll work with them for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And it's hard when you run into someone in a totally different context. Like, if you'd met at another convention, that probably would have been really easy.
Yeah.
But in a totally different part of your life, that gets harder.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So how long did you guys work together at Disruptor Beam? How long were you there?
A year or two?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
A couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously, you're both at different jobs now. Just to be clear, but
Cool. So we were kind of
hoping to talk about storytelling and how that works into role playing games. And some of us, you know, honestly resist calling our role playing games stories. And some people work more to work that into the games. So maybe like an overall philosophy. Where are you with that these days, Adriel?
So the thing about role-playing games, right, is they're this, like, interesting hybrid between a narrative, like in a novel, and an open-world game, right? Like, theoretically, you could do literally anything, but you've got these constraints placed on you by the rules of the game, by your GM and by the other players. And so there's this interesting liminal space where it's like you want there to be the opportunity for literally anything, but you also want to tell a cohesive story. And as a person who designs and writes games and who reads a lot, that's something I just spend a lot of time mulling over. I don't know that I have like a way of summarizing it, but it's cognizant, like it's like right at the front of my brain whenever I'm writing or running a game. Like, how much of this am I going to like do totally off the cuff in that like open space that could be anything, and how much of it am I going to try and focus to get my players from a point A to a point B, because I know that point B is what leads me to our next session.
Hey, Adriel, I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off here for a second, but so we're getting a lot of comments about the buzz coming from your mic, which we saw earlier. Can you just do me a favor and hit that refresh again? Because that seemed to work for us before, and I'm hoping that'll solve it. Thanks so much. Bear with us, everyone. Real quick, live stream, super fun.
Fingers crossed.
Go ahead, Adriel.
Did that help?
Yeah, you sound better to me. Absolutely. Phew, yeah. Absolutely. Okay,
cool.
Great.
So yeah, I'll, if it happens again, just let me know.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That fix seems to work. So yeah, we'll cool. I'll butt in if you start buzzing again. Great.
Awesome. And cool. Thanks for the folks in the chat confirming that actually. It is interesting because on the one hand, you want in one of those gaming sessions, you kind of want, as you were saying, Adriel, you kind of want a satisfying experience in that session, right? But at the same time, you do want it to lead into this longer campaign later on. So I think probably we've both. Wrestled sometimes. Oh, there's that. Trying to find a satisfying conclusion to a particular session without cutting off opportunities in the future.
Right.
Have you found any particular strategies to find that balance well in your games?
So one thing that I tried in the excellence, and I think that it works, is that as a group, not just the GM is establishing what's going on in the game, right? Like, you get together, you create your characters, and then you answer a series of questions about the adventure you're about to have. So you decide together, who's the big bad? Who's supporting the big bad? Where do we want our episode to open? And where do we want our episode to end? And the thing that that does for me when I'm running games, and hopefully for other folks when they are running themselves and playing, is that creates a really nice bookend to guide me and my players from point A to point B. And like, for me, it almost feels like kind of a safety net as a GM. I'm just like, okay, this could go anywhere, but I know that I have to get us to X before the end of the session.
Gotcha. Now, I will admit that's very different from how like I run classic, right, old school D&D sessions, is I have no idea where it's going to end up, and I kind of am at the mercy, right, of where the dice and where the players take us. And I certainly personally don't make any prediction about where we're going to land. But, you know, sometimes we wind up in like a weird or awkward place, or like the time is weird or something like that. So it's interesting for someone like yourself working in a more explicitly narrative space to hear about the struggle it can be to get to where your target is at the end of a session. So that's really interesting to hear about the tools that you use to get there.
Yeah. So what are your players focused more on the goal of the session? Like, we want to destroy X monster or collect Y amount of treasure.
Well, that's a really great question from someone that runs narrative games. I mean, you know, classically D&D had a place, like what I can come to the table and is I can provide a place. Which could be like a mega dungeon. And I was doing that for like about the last year and a half. And there can be rumors about treasures, and there can be rumors about magic items that might be in particular locations. And it is up to players to come up with what part of this world do we want to pursue and target for which of these rumors sounds like a good goal to us. So the way I've been doing it recently is I do try to seed rumors about things and places and objects, and it is the players to pursue what part of the world or what part of the mega dungeon. And going into it, I don't know myself where they're going to go, and they frequently surprise me. And so I get at least as, even though I'm the one bringing the location, bringing the set piece, I get as surprised about as anyone about what goals they picked.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this touches a bit on what we were talking about before the show about sort of improvisation and where it happens in the game, right? I'm kind of curious, actually, if this somewhat tends in one direction versus the other when we consider campaign play versus convention play or any kind of one-off type play, right? Where in a campaign, you expect this kind of ongoing, constant, like, we don't know where this is going to end up a month from now, a year from now, however long we play. Whereas in a convention game or any one-shot game you're going to play, like, you expect a certain arc, right? And you may never see these people again or the same specific group again. So you're looking for, how do we get that climax in? How do we get a resolution in at the end that feels satisfying so we can all walk away and say, as a whole, the game was cohesive and fun?
Yeah.
True. You know, so right before the show, we were talking, you know, comics a little bit. And so I am an old, you know, Marvel superhero fan myself. And Adriel, you were saying you read more indie stuff these days. And so I guess before I go on about that, just tell us again for the viewers, like, what kind of comics you read commonly nowadays.
So I was reading, or am still reading, Sophie Campbell's run of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because I've liked TMNT since I was a kid. But I tend to more read indie comics. So a lot of graphic novels from Oni Press. I love the T-Dragon Society set of novels. There are two of them. Mostly like comics that have something to do with magic or mystical creatures or witches, stuff like that. That's sort of my comic focus.
Cool. Cool. You know, it's funny because in January we had Joe Manganiello and Steve Wilson. Is that right?
Steve McCauley.
Steve McCauley. And they both said that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were like really huge for them to getting into fantasy and getting into role playing. So we seem to have an ongoing theme about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and maybe we should do a show about that.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Other Strangeness was my first role-playing game. Like, when I was in first grade, I remember, like, watching my uncles and my grandfather play D&D, and obviously I couldn't play with them because I was a five-year-old child, but, like, that had a huge, like, impact on me. And when I was old enough to, like, be reading comics and for my dad to get me stuff I was interested in, I wanted that role-playing game, and I spent hours just like reading the main book over and over again, not even really playing, but just engaging with it as a tool to tell my own stories, if that makes sense.
absolutely. And I think many of us have the experience of like getting or collecting books, and at least for certain phases of our life, taking more time reading it than actually playing. And certainly when I was 13 years old, I had Gary Gygax's Dungeon Master's Guide, and I carried it everywhere. I carried it everywhere, nice. To school and to classes and to restaurants and in the car, and I was just reading it over and over and over again, even when I wasn't running games. So I think we've all had that kind of experience, and at some point in our life, we have an opportunity to share that with other people, which is super nice, and then that blossoms forth.
Yeah.
So go on, Adriel.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to switch tracks on us. So if you have a follow-up, I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah, it just like I think that as a game designer, like I think that I couldn't do, I mean, I can do many things creatively because I like making stuff, but like this is where my brain is at because I spent so much time in that headspace as a kid that it's like when I want to introduce a world or tell a story, I want to give people the structure and I want them to create their own narrative out of what I've given them.
That's great. So before we go on to another track, let me just talk a little bit about comics. So as a Marvel guy, like a little while ago, right? It's the comics episode is what it is.
Yeah.
my favorite comic book characters is Marvel's Thor, honestly. And so now that they finally had a good movie finally with the last Thor movie, I'm like really excited about that. And so I got the collections of the original Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, you know, Thor issues when they started out. It was originally called Journey into Mystery. And it's interesting because when they first started out, they were all self-contained episodes, right?
Yeah.
Every issue was a complete start, finish. That was the end. You probably saw that one villain one single time and you assumed you'd never see them again. And you can see as time goes on, they discovered, there's this moment when they discovered the idea of multi-issue story arcs. And it actually had, the specific moment is in 1963, they have their first, it's actually from issue 99 to issue 100, they have their first, this story is going to be continued for the first time, right? And it's kind of interesting how they discover that and they wrestle with these same issues of like, what's the balance between single session stories versus multi-session stories? And obviously nowadays, the whole comic book industry is set up assuming you're going to collect your stories into graphic novels.
Yeah.
Maybe like about six issues. And the whole marketing is always, here's the start of a new arc and here's the end of a new arc. So it's really interesting to see that someone had to discover that at some point. And you can actually kind of pinpoint the exact moment when they thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you take any ideas about those story structures from comic books and use them in your games, or has it been like all totally separate theories?
It's less comic books and more genre television.
Okay.
But it's sort of the same beast, right? Like, you know that you have a season of a show, and presumably you know going into the production of that show, this is how many episodes we have. We want to leave it open for if we get renewed, i.e. if we're going to play another campaign of this game. But we do want to tell a cohesive narrative from the beginning to the end. However, we can't only focus on that narrative because it won't keep people coming back. You need to seed smaller B plots, so to speak, to keep that interest and that excitement going week over week. And so that is more of an influence on the games that I'm writing. So like with the excellence, that influence is straight up out of 90s cartoons and, you know, the reboots of She-Ra and like Steven Universe and Adventure Time, like new cartoons that are happening now that are sort of changing what can be said with cartoons. So that was the focus of the excellence. But Mazes, which my design and business partner, Chris O'Neill, has designed and written, focuses, I think, more towards that comic book side. It's not a comic book narrative. It's very much a pulp fiction narrative, like pulp fiction as in small pulp fantasy novellas, not pulp fiction as in, you know, movies about drugs and stuff. Because, like, his influence, like, his primary, thing that he was looking at was how the Conan stories, similar to the Thor stories, were each individual stories in each book. And the time and the order in which you read them really didn't matter, because the hero isn't going through an internal hero's journey where he becomes a better person. He's a fully formed hero who can do all the things, and here's an adventure he's having. And so for ninth level games, like, that's super our narrative focus right now, is that novella style gameplay from Mazes, cartoon style gameplay from the excellence, and then as we're writing more titles in the Polymorph line, they are going to have more of that episode to episode, but an entire season or series focus. Does that make sense? That was a long answer.
Yeah, okay. You know, that's really coherent. That's actually really interesting to hear, as a matter of fact. Now, Paul, I know that you have been a big fan of some of the things she just mentioned there, like Adventure Time and Steve.
Yeah, Universe. Yeah, I was hoping to get back to that. So to go back to the excellence, when I read the excellence, the first thing that jumped into my head, of course, was Adventure Time. Like, I thought, oh, this feels like Adventure Time. And I think one of the interesting things about you know, cartoons like Adventure Time or Steven Universe is that even though that they are episodic, they are, I feel like, as say compared to cartoons I watched as a child in the 80s, that they are more bringing in these kind of overarching themes or larger scale plots where there are big unanswered questions, and they're referencing earlier episodes and advancing, right? Having actual like character advancement, which generally you didn't see when, like, you know, in like say a He-Man episode where they're just trying to sell toys.
Yeah.
Adriel, I'm going to ask you real quick to refresh again. You're starting to get a little bit of a crackle. Let's nip that one in the bud. Great. Thank you very much. I'm gonna vamp here for a second until Adriel's. Oh, that's super fast. Okay, that's great. So you're good. You're good.
Good.
So I guess I'm curious. Like, what? You know, did you think about that at all when you were writing the Excellence? What kind of elements did you put into the game where you're thinking about more episodic or like one-off games versus, you know, adding in those hooks for long, progressive story plots that maybe, I presume maybe you don't know the full arc of in advance, or maybe you do. I don't know. What do you expect for that?
So with the Excellence, Chris and I were both initially like, we want to play in the world of Adventure Time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of ways a person could do that. But because we are game designers and writers, we're like, well, clearly we'll just make up our own game. That's the way to get what we want. So it was huge inspiration there. So it's awesome that you picked up on that. And with regard to that sort of that setup and the decision to focus on episodes versus long campaigns, that mostly came out of the fact that I spend a lot of my gaming time at conventions, right? So a lot of the games I play are convention games. And I wanted to be able to get into something immediately without needing to have that long-term commitment or someone saying, I am going to GM this for forever, right? Like, I wanted something that was quick, easy to pick up, accessible to everyone, and that you could get a real good, fun adventure from just like an hour to 3 hours of gameplay. However, I think we probably went a little light on how a campaign could work in the book. And probably were we to revisit it, I would expand on that a little bit. But we have a lot of products coming down the pipe for Polymorph, which is the system the Excellence in Mazes is based on, which is a one die per player system. And with that, I think that we're going to be able to expand a little bit more. So like with Mazes, we did Zine Quest last year for the first four issues. And with Zine Quest this year, we set it up to do a five zine over the course of the year, like publishing cycle for the next product in Mazes. And what those books are going to do are going to expand further on the world of Mazes, give players more options, and focus a little bit on if you want to run a long-term campaign. And once that work is done, that's going to feed back into what we're calling right now the Polymorph Construction Kit, which is a product we're putting together that, like, you, the player, and your group get the skeleton of Polymorph and what the underlying rules are, and you get to fill in what your game's going to be about. And we were only able to do it once because unfortunately we're all sheltering in place like we're supposed to. But we had this idea and we did it at a couple cons last year, and we'll bring it back once cons get going again, where everybody in the room creates a Polymorph game together. They play the game, we lay it out and print it, and then you can purchase a copy to take home with you of this game that you just made together and played.
That's pretty clever. That's pretty neat. Yeah. I mean, that kind of collaborative world building, I think, is very interesting. I've definitely played campaigns like that in the past where we start with fairly bare bones and sit down and try to collaboratively world build up front. It's not always easy, but it's you can come up with some really interesting stuff. Sorry. So for the let me go back to the excellence again. So one of the funny things I found. Sorry, I'm gonna keep dragging this back there, but you know, one of the amusing things I think there, right, is that drawing this reference to Adventure Time and its you know, and I know I've heard the stories about how Adventure Time itself was inspired by a D&D game run by the creators. So it's this lovely, like, feedback loop. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can never remember the name of that snake. Okay.
Ouroboros.
Ouroboros. Yeah. There you go. Thank you. You know, I think it is, you know, I haven't gotten a chance to sit down and play it yet, but I'm actually, you know, there are certain convention games that I love to play for that expectation of an arc within a single session. I tend to play a lot of Fiasco. That's the last one I played at. We did an online convention a week ago, and I think that similar to the excellence, it has this very strong touch point into like known genres or known specific fiction. Fiasco specifically mentions the movie Fargo in it, where if everyone at the table can recognize the reference, like immediately you get theme and you get, you know, character ideas and whatnot. And then a lot of stuff in Fiasco is then play sets of like, no, but now we're also going to jam in this other reference, this well-known, you know, trope that we're all going to broil ourselves in. But then it forces a specific arc, right? There's an act one, there's a twist, there's an act two, there's a resolution mechanic. And also, I think like what you were saying before, in the very beginning of the game, it's set up to say, hey, this is a game about people who make terrible choices and fail miserably. So we all expect, right? Like, even if we don't know the exact arc of what's going to happen in the game, our expectation is set up front that by the end, it's going to unravel in a hilarious and terrible way. Do you have something similar in the excellence? Is that part of that intro cycle that you do with players when you're sort of making characters, where you're establishing, here's our expectation of the overarching plot, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For me, and I hope I included this and made it clear in the book, the excellence is about having adventures with your friends, and nothing truly terrible is going to happen. It's more about how do we solve our problems together as a group? And maybe can we focus on different ways of resolving our main conflict that don't necessarily resort to violence immediately? Like, a lot of RPGs are about combat, right? Because you need to have a conflict in order to, like, work through something or tell a story or just move something forward. But with the excellence, I want those conflicts to be about emotions and about being a better person. Because, like, there are a lot of games that you can play if you want to do that combat conflict stuff. And that's awesome. And I want to play some of those games too. But there's a space for more games where that conflict is something gentler and more a thing we could encounter every day, right? Like, every day I'm not gonna fight an orc and either die or kill the orc, but every day I do need to be kind to others with my words and, obey basic rules that help us live together as a society, you know, like that kind of thing. And that's really where I wanted to go with the excellence, but in a really fun cartoon package, because nobody wants moral lessons handed down to them
<That's>
in
<great. laughs>
like vegetable format, you know?
You know, it the funny thing is, it reminds me a lot, honestly, of the sessions I'm running these days of a stream show I put on called 10 Dead Rats, which is actually thematically the polar opposite. We're playing in the Warhammer world, which is grim and perilous, and the players are going to just constantly fail and get beat on. But that said, again, it's drawing focus away from those mechanics of heavy combats and whatnot, because they know they can't possibly survive. They know they're in over their heads all the time. And so the game becomes much more focused on, you know, how do we get out of this? How do we be clever and find other routes around and also spend more time reacting to each other, to the environment, and spending more of just the actual play hours in those sort of in-between moments, right, of talking to each other and dealing with the situation at hand and possibly then laying plans for what to do about it in the future.
Yeah,
and you know,
nice.
I got it. So Eddie, when this comes up, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself on the show, but so obviously, you know, D&D itself, you know, pivots out of the wargaming tradition, and the original D&D box, you know, they didn't even have the word role playing at the time. The original D&D box actually says rules for fantasy wargame campaign is what it says, and
yeah.
So there's this story of when Dave Wesley was running his what we now know as Bronstein Games, whatever this was, the around 1970, and he set up a war game at a convention, and he had 10 people show up to, you know, run the different parts of the war game campaign, and then they actually spent the entire session semi accidentally just talking to each other, and no war game occurred, right? And he yep. walked away, and he's like, I set up this whole actual miniature war game, and it never happened. And he said, I thought that was the biggest failure in gaming of my life. And then people couldn't stop talking about how interesting it was after the fact. And the writer, John Peterson, has this phrase that I just love to death. He says, now we have been failing at wargaming for a long time. And it's obviously tongue-in-cheek, right? It's we've discovered something that's really better in some ways. But I really love the phrasing of the whole role-playing industry as failing at wargaming for a long time.
That's great.
So it's nice that we've discovered it's discovered something even richer than what it started out at, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's what, you know, that's what made D&D so special, right? Is the adding in that element of anything can happen, and it's a bigger, more open world, and it's not just, you know, swinging your sword at orcs. Which we already had. We had that in war games. Not to say, right. I don't want to swing my sword at orcs. I love doing that. Don't want 100% of my game to have that, but maybe, you know, somewhere around the 20 to 50% mark is about right for me.
Yep, agreed.
So
agreed.
One thing that when I started verbing games, like working in the game industry and designing and stuff like that, that I came to this conclusion that, like, all games have two underlying pieces. There's your mechanics and your genre, or the skin on top of the game. And, like, I discovered that for me personally, I am a, like, theme narrative down person, right? I'll play any mechanics if I like your theme. But I think that there are many gamers out there who go from mechanics outwards, right? Like, they want a specific type of experience, and the icing on the cake of that experience is if it is a theme that they also enjoy, but they're primarily there for the, like, the action of it, right? Like, for the miniatures game, you know, aspect of, like, measuring and figuring out area of effect and stuff like that. And in some role-playing games are on the more mechanics-heavy side, and some are on the more narrative-heavy side. And I tend to write on the narrative-heavy side because I want to engage on the narrative-heavy side, even though I love heavy mechanics stuff. For a long time, I played War Machine and Hordes because, like, it got me what I wanted out of a miniatures game without being quite as heavy as Warhammer.
I think that we, like, all three of us here kind of like, you know, somewhat lighter mechanics than some systems to get out of the way when we do want to write content or narratives or places or people or things. And it's funny because, I mean, just last night I was on our channel, I was running because I have a lightweight war game system called Book of War that I was actually just running on the channel last night. With my partner Isabel here, and it only took an hour, right? And we actually it got done within 59 minutes. And at the end, I was like, "Well, in Warhammer, that would have been 3 or 4 or 5 hours." and this whole thing just wraps up in an hour, and that was less content than I expected. So I think that for many of us that are designers and writers, and I think a lot of people, even if they're writing, you know, even if they're publishing for fifth edition, a lot of, you know, maybe older designers, they write an adventure and original first because it's lightweight, and then they do this conversion process.
Yes.
Heavyweight rule systems really get in the way when you're actually trying to write or design something.
Real quick, Adriel, there's a joke going on in the chat that maybe your mic's on about a 15-minute timer. So
oh,
why don't you go ahead and, why don't you go ahead and hit that refresh button for us again, and we'll trundle on. Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent.
Better?
Great. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. It's super weird.
I don't know
super
why
weird.
That's happening.
Yeah, very strange. But at least we have a workaround.
Yeah, we do,
which is nice. We have an alert in the chat.
Right. I plugged my mic into a USB hub, which is what's going into my laptop. And maybe there's something there that's not connecting
well. Maybe it's just
well.
Not quite getting enough power or something. And
Yeah.
Like a buffer filling up or something, maybe. I'm going to switch if that's okay, Paul.
Yeah, okay. Go for it.
We've been talking about all this light, touchy-feely feelers with the narratives, but now it's time to talk about mechanics and math. So when I read the excellence, right, I was really surprised and really impressed by your dice mechanic. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. And as you can see on the Polymorph logo that's on screen now, right, the whole, as you said, every player gets exactly one die. That's the end of it. And you've got a D4, 6, 8, and 10 in the game. And I'll forgive the use of the D10 non-platonic die. That's fine. I accept that. Right. But it's really interesting that different skills have different success ranges. Right. So that some dice are actually advantageous for some skills and they're disadvantageous for others. So maybe you, Adriel, could talk more about the specifics of how that mechanic works, because I thought that was like really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So credit where credit is due. This mechanic is all Chris. Like, he has been working on the polymorph mechanics for years. And I played. So where the excellence like actually sprung from is we have this convention every year called NotCon, and it's where like about 35 of us get together. We rent a house. The house has an indoor pool. We spend the better part of a week playing games, eating food, and just hanging out. So at NotCon years ago, Chris brought a proto version of Polymorph specifically set up so we could play an Adventure Time game. And we played through it. It was awesome. I immediately was like, this. I love this. This is all I want to do with role playing because I can grok it really quickly. I have played a lot of role playing games, but I tend to, like, if it's too much work, I'm not going to do it. So here it was like, oh my gosh, there's no work at all. And we get this super cool adventure. So Chris spent a lot of time refining that, and in early versions of Polymorph, so we were initially working on The Excellence and a game called Good Dogs, which is about dogs in the Chernobyl exclusion zone fighting Cthulhu-type horrors. So
nice! Oh, God!
I want to play that. Holy crap. Right.
Yes. I promise you will get that game. We're working on it this year. So, like, in that game and in The Excellence, we had initially tried it with 5 dice. So it was D4 through 10 plus the 12. And we found that mechanically, the 12 just didn't function as well as the other dice. So we cut it out and we started playtesting with just the 4. And once we got to just the 4, it felt better all the time. Now, because some dice are more mechanically better at certain things. Paul, could you put up the character sheet for The Excellence?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you. So if you'll notice that books and shoes are like, they're almost the only rolls that a D4 can make, right? Like, they can make a sword roll, but they're pretty unlikely to. And that's why we did the thing with the crown as the top number on your die and the beast as the bottom number. So in the excellence, and we change this mechanic depending on the game and how perilous it needs to be, but in the excellence, when you roll your crown, always a success because it's the top number on your die. And so you get to narrate through that success. And then with a one, because we needed to give players more options for success, the one is your beast friend. And if you can narrative your way through your beast friend helping you in a certain situation, that also gives your role a success. So in excellence, the system is light, but also very forgiving. In Mazes and the game that I'm working on right now, Savage Sisters, which is a companion to Mazes, it's basically like barbarian women in tribes trying to save like the world as it is related to them. There are mechanics that when you fail a roll, it adds to your despair total. And your despair total can push your rolls to be advantaged or disadvantaged. And your wealth total in Savage Sisters gives you advantage. And what advantage and disadvantage do is, one, give the GM the power to sort of like push things in a failing or a succeeding direction, but they also give the player a lot of room to decide what they want to have happen and hopefully work through that narrative with each other. Does that make sense?
Great. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And maybe just go back to the character sheet. Go back to the excellence character sheet. So just to be clear, maybe for our viewers, right? So there's, you know, so there's one player at the table who's picked a D4 for their die. And if they're going after the, as you can see, as the books or shoes skills, they've got a 50% chance to succeed at that by rolling a D4.
Right.
And then there's another player who's picked a D10 die. And the chance of them rolling one of those things is only like 2 in 10, like only 20%. But on the other hand, the chance of them rolling one of those crown or heart targets is fully 50%. Which the care with the player with the D4 almost can't do at all. So it has the flavor. I'm not surprised that you say this has been refined over years because it's so solid that this has the flavor of something that someone did not just make up one day and just throw out in a PDF. It's clearly like really been refined. It seems super solid. I've never seen anything like that. And for me, I mean, the best games are always when you can, you know, marry those two sides of have mechanics and, you know, genre working together at the same level. And I think you guys are doing a really amazing job about that. And I really want to play the Dogs Fighting Cthulhu. And I think I want to play the unleashed women prisoners in the post-apocalyptic world too. Those are great ideas for games.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I really like that you're adapting this great mechanic to other genres, but then also incorporating specific, you know, tuning it to that genre. You know, this was sort of, honestly, this is sort of the problem I had with Savage Worlds was, it's a great system. And I was an old Deadlands player. I love Deadlands. They simplified it a bunch in Savage Worlds and then tried to make it uber generic. And I think it lost some of its charm because, you know, Deadlands had all these nice things that like, all these mechanics where I really felt like I was in an old spaghetti Western.
Right.
When you start trying to like genericize it too much, I don't know, it gets a little bland.
Give us some detail to that. Like maybe some of our viewers aren't aware of the original Deadlands mechanic.
Yeah. So the original Deadlands game, it had playing cards, right? So it's set in old West sort of spaghetti Western setting, but then also has supernatural elements. Your spellcaster types are basically card sharks, and so they're drawing cards to play, and they're trying to make poker hands to succeed at their spells. Likewise, chips are used. Poker chips are used a lot, both as like health markers, and they're used in other ways. But it had all these little, you know, physical props that are actually part of the mechanics, but evoked the setting, which I really loved. They happen because you have cards. Now we have got cards at the table. Then they also use the cards for initiative. So you'd get dealt a card for your initiative and you would use that as your initiative tracker. Savage Worlds retains that, So Savage Worlds is a generic system, and I don't mean to knock Savage Worlds, great system, I still use it for a bunch of stuff, but they tried to be really, you know, uber, you can run sci-fi, you can run horror, you can run pulp, whatever. And the funny thing is, what I found is I stopped using the cards for initiative in some of those other settings because it doesn't provoke the genre, and it's just a little clunky. And I don't mind it being clunky when I'm like, ooh, but it makes me feel like I'm a card shark in the Old West. But when it's clunky and doesn't fit the genre, then I'm like, why am I doing this?
Totally. Totally.
Yeah, I think, like, you can't put every theme onto every mechanic. You have to, think about the strengths and weaknesses of those mechanics and try and pair those two things together. And I think the most successful games out there do that, right? They're cognizant of those strengths and weaknesses of their mechanics, mm-hmm. and they use that to support their theme, and they use the theme to support the mechanics. And I think that's super, super important when you're making a game.
Yeah, super totally
well
agree.
Put. Super well put. I agree.
I mean, I think it's really interesting to, like, I bet that a lot of designers are naively looking out for, like, well, I just don't want no weaknesses. How about I have no weaknesses and all only strengths? Like, that's just not possible, right? But way better if your weaknesses, like I said, in the Deadlands setting, where a weakness of, like, maybe a slightly clunky initiative system is also evocative of the genre. You're turning your weakness into a strength a little bit. And I think that's incredibly clever.
Yeah, agreed.
Right. I mean, for me in D&D, my canonical example is I like the fact that the players playing wizards have to take a big physical book and leaf through a bunch of pages for a bunch of cryptic spell descriptions, right? And only, mm-hmm. you know, probably only the wizard players are at the table with a book leafing through it trying to find the right spell. And for me, I'm very happy about the wizards being complicated and forcing you to do more reading is something that I'm very happy about. I don't know how accidental that was, but I've always really actually kind of enjoyed that about D&D. And I agree that you ought to be willing to modify those mechanics. The systems that have tried to be fully generic and fully universal and mandate the exact same mechanics haven't tended to stand the test of time so much. Not a whole lot of people stick with those systems forever. So I agree. They need to be working together.
The analogy I always use is you end up with a sofa bed mechanic, right? It is neither a good sofa nor a good bed. Technically, it doesn't.
Yes. As a person who just moved and needs to get a new couch, that is especially relevant. Do we get a couch? We get a sofa bed.
Well, before we run out of time, I'm going to switch tracks on us one more time because I want to talk about Monster Mix. Now, this is a solo project you did, Adriel, recently. Did a Kickstarter for it. I'm eagerly awaiting my copy. Tell us, I guess, you know, give our viewers a little bit of an overview of what is this and why'd you make it? And
I like...
Oh, and wait, I'm going to cut you off and ask you to refresh before you start.
Okay.
Great.
Okay, better?
Yes.
Excellent. Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, I love listening to music. I love making playlists. And on Facebook, I started a group with my friends. And this stemmed out of years ago when I would make mix CDs for my friends. I started a club called The Chapter House. And in The Chapter House, you pick a theme, you make a mix, and you create the art for that CD cover, whatever, and send it to all your friends, right? And then in the era of streaming, I'm like, cool, let's just use Spotify for this. So I created a Facebook group, and I would give people a theme every month that they needed to fulfill with their mix. And I realized at some point that, like, I thought that was a really neat mechanic, and that... things change when you give someone a playlist, right? With whatever your intention is. Like when we're teenagers and we're trying to tell someone we have a crush on them and we make them this epic playlist that's like, oh, this is my heart. I'm reaching out to you without actually saying those words. For 200 word RPG this year, I wasn't going to do anything. And then at the last minute, I was like, you know what? What the heck? I'll write a playlist game. So I wrote a game where each player answers a series of questions and some of the questions you answer with the other player. It's a two-player game. And then you make a playlist. You listen to those playlists, and then you get back together and you answer some more questions together. So it's sort of like a storytelling game, because it's not like there's any mechanics that will get you from, like, adventure point A to adventure point B, but the adventure is all sort of internal. And I did that 200-word RPG, and then ZineQuest came around, and for some reason, I was just like, I need to make something, and I need to make it from scratch. I need to come up with the idea, and I need to also manufacture the physical product. What's good for that? Zines. So for ZineQuest, I decided to expand on that 200-word RPG, and I decided to make it monster-themed. So the goal of the game is each player selects what kind of monster they are, and there'll be a chart you can roll on if you don't want to choose yourself. And I'll have a brief description. And then you answer some questions collectively with the other player about, like, the time period that you're set in. Is it modern? Is it, you know, like, are you adults? Are you kids? Like, what's your age range? That kind of thing. Then you make your playlist. And the goal of your playlist is for the other player to listen to it and be able to figure out what kind of monster you are. So once you made your playlist, you've shared them with each other, you listen, and then you come back together and you have a conversation. And you also talk about, like, oh, knowing that my friend's a werewolf, does that change how I feel about them? And so it just sort of was like a way to talk about heavy things where we're talking about ourselves and our feelings, but in a sort of light, one step removed from ourselves activity. And then I needed stretch goals. So I was like, well, what do I like to do? I like to cook and make things. So I'll share some things I like to cook and make with people. So I included a recipe for oatcakes, a recipe for blood cake, and a recipe instructions for making a sharp knife out of a butter knife, which, to fit the monster theme, I'm going to throw a little, like, witchy stuff in there, like how to turn this into an athame. So, that's, yeah, awesome. Yeah, sort of a weird eclectic product that I was like, I just want to make it.
It's super neat. And it jumped out at me for a couple of reasons. One is, certainly I had a friend in high school where we did this a lot of trading mixes. That's definitely a thing that I'm used to. So that sort of struck home for me. But then the other thing is just recently, I mean, the fact that it's a two-player game, that it has almost this somewhat asynchronous nature where we're going to play a little bit, then I'm going to go back and I'm going to make this mix and whatnot, and then I'm going to come back. It strikes me actually as a really great game for the situation we're in right now. Many of us are trapped in a house with maybe only one other person, or would like a game that doesn't require a lot of logistics to set up. If I just know one person I can connect with and we're going to do this, and maybe even do some of it over email or whatnot, or something more asynchronous, and then have a, you know, video call at the end or something to do the wrap up. It's super great. So I'm anxious. I hope they're coming out soon, because I'm anxious to read it.
It's so I think I said on Kickstarter that it would ship in August, but I'm hoping I can do it earlier than that, because now that I have lots of time on my hands, I have plenty of time to work on layout and printing it myself. Because part of the Kickstarter was like, I'm either going to get it printed by a local printer who did mazes for us, who we know that their product is amazing, but they are currently shut down. So I'm like, well, I'm going to be even more hands-on, and I'm going to print the paper myself and bind it. So it's going to be great.
That's awesome. Cool. That's fantastic.
Thanks.
Paul in the past has bound certain products, and I got one thing from him, and it is the single most precious and valuable gaming anything that I ever received. So when someone does get that that artisanal, handcrafted touch, it really puts it over the top.
I hope so. Thank you. Yeah. Artifacts are such a huge thing in gaming that we don't talk about a lot. Like, it's like any hobby that you have, right? Like if you collect records and you have like, oh, I've got this first pressing signed by the band. But like for role playing, those artifacts are very different. And the meaning that comes from them is almost more about the meaning that the owner assigns as opposed to any outside material value. And I think that's so cool.
Totally. And I was going to say the same thing. My friends in music, you know, the LP resurgence in the last couple of years has become a huge thing, is they want the big artifact and they want, you know, their band's new music on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, LP sales have been increasing increasing the last 5 or 6 years, so that people have something they can display in their living room as like, this is part of my identity. And I, you know, and I don't want like lots and lots and lots of stuff in my life, but a couple well-selected chosen things that I can, you know, carry for a long time is important.
Yep.
I agree.
Yeah. Probably the only, audio cassettes still, in a closet somewhere for me are those mixtapes that were given to me as a younger person, right? Like anything that was manufactured at this point, I can get that music somewhere else, but.
Right.
Right. The handcraftedness of it being a mix that was intentionally chosen. Like, no, I have to retain that.
Because that's like, that's so meaningful. That's someone making those choices of something they wanted to share with you specifically. Like, you can't beat that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have like, you know, like in our house, we have a couple greeting cards, right? So we like many greeting cards have come through the house. And if they're manufactured, they have come and they've gone. But things that have been handmade, we tend to hang on to for a longer amount of time. And that's the signal that someone really is interested in you as a person.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're about running out of time, so let me, we've been trying to give us a final thoughts question, and gosh, we've been so far all over the map, from comics to plot to handcrafted artifacts. Adriel, any final thoughts on any of those topics, anything that you were hoping we would get to that we haven't, that you want us to talk about?
I think we covered most of what I wanted to talk about, and I just want to say thank you so much for having me on your show to talk about this stuff, because it's been really fun.
Awesome. Well, that's certainly our goal. We started this show just so that we could talk to each other more frequently, right? And then I guess other people can watch. That's fine.
That's it. We feel really honored to have you on, and we feel lucky to have had you today, Adriel. So thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Yeah. Dan, any closing thoughts on any of our topics?
I it's been such a pleasure today, and I'm, you know, I really like the point of having, I think all of us agree, having you know, narrative genre stuff work cooperatively with your mechanical stuff, and I think that's a really important point, that the best possible situation is have those things pulling in the same direction, and I think that's a really important thing to try to get to happen. Yeah. I feel like that was huge. So remember that. So Paul, do you have, anything else?
No, we're good. Go on, Dan. I sense you're wrapping us up. Give us the wrap up.
We are wrapping up. Yes, I'm going to wrap up. So thank you to the viewers today. Actually, there's a lot of chat that we didn't get to, so I'm going to have to go back and actually read all that chat and see if there's any comments that I missed. So thank you for that. And remember that anybody that's new today, you can like and you can follow and you can subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle Wandering DMs on all of those locations.
And our show is also available on audio-only format if you prefer to watch the show that way or listen to the show that way. Please visit us on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find that on various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Google Podcasts. And if you are listening to our show on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. It helps us a lot.
That's so true. Thanks again to Adriel Wilson today. And please look for her stuff with Ninth Level Games and the Polymorph systems, such as the Excellence and Mazes. Really, really top-notch stuff there that they've worked on that really shows the mark of that's been refined really well. Thanks again to all of our patrons who make this show possible. We could not do this at this time without you. If you'd like to join them in supporting our show, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And don't forget that we are live with the chat show every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We currently have three other shows per week. So watch for the Paul and Dan solo play show Tuesday night. Look for 10 Dead Rats Thursday night, and look for Book of War Episode 3 next Saturday. But we'll be back next Sunday with a chat show at 1 p.m. Eastern time for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.